From runasradio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 615, Windows Customer Experience with guest Chris Jackson, recorded Monday, October 15th, 2018. Run As Radio is produced each week by Quap Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. Thank you, listeners, for listening to Run As Radio. This is Richard Campbell, and I'm talking to my friend Chris Jackson today, who's now a principal architect in the Experience and Devices Group, specializing in cybersecurity, application compatibility, and modernizing software assets. And he leads enterprise adoption of Windows as a Service, Windows Defender ATP, and Microsoft Edge. Welcome back, sir. It's been a couple of years.
Hey, always a pleasure, my friend. Always a pleasure to chat with you. Yeah, I was disappointed that I did not make it to Ignite to sit down and have a chat in person.
Oh, yeah. I was going to feed you to other podcasters, just so you know. I help run that podcasting space, and I'm bringing in podcasts from all over the place to have conversations. Because, I mean, I've got your number. I can reach you anytime I want. So, sort of my role is combining Microsoft guests with shows that you may not have gotten on before. I thought you would have been great on Security Weekly, for example. I think that's what I was actually hacking on. But you were in Italy? You were having some fun, as I recall.
I was actually taking a proper vacation, which is not normally my style. It's a new muscle I'm trying to develop.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
But it was basically a car vacation. It was visiting all of the car meccas of Italy. So.
Oh, my goodness. There's a ton of them. Driving the Autostrada all by itself is an experience. But you went and saw Ferrari and Lamborghini and all of those sorts of places?
Indeed, I did. And Pagani. Don't forget Pagani.
Oh, and Pagani. Yes. Horatio Pagani. There's a character. What I find interesting in this new title, this Windows Customer Experience Engineering, the combination of cybersecurity and application compatibility, those things go together?
They do indeed. So I'll kind of divide those two up and talk a little bit first about what is customer experience engineering, because that's actually a relatively new thing within Microsoft.
Okay.
When we sort of look at how we build products, you know, historically, we always had a trio. We had dev, we had test, we had PM. Right, all sort of working together to build it.
Right.
And, you know, we kind of rolled dev and test together. So, you know, because so much test, particularly at the scale of things we're building now, has to be automated, that you have to be a dev in order to write tests that can scale to the size of the code that we're working with and the problems that we're trying to solve. So you kind of took that and went down to dev and PM. And what we're trying to do now is inject a third leg into that stool, which is the customer themselves. So specifically, I spend my time working with, thinking about, talking to others who work with the customers to represent their scenarios into all of our product planning, product testing, and the things that we're trying to build.
Cool. And yeah, you know, the idea that we're kind of not going to have another version of Windows, it seems. You're just going to keep doing updates. It's all Windows 10 now. So are you helping to pick what gets built next?
The customers are.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what we do as a team, is we, you know, find ways to interact with customers, both, you know, sort of light touch breadth motions and very heavy touch depth motions, you know, through white glove deployments and things like that, to really see and understand the scenarios and then go and fight for them, right? So I view that as my job is to be the person fighting for our customers to get the things they need built and delivered in the product and get that early feedback and being able to turn around like we've just simply never been able to do in the past.
Now, this seems like a stunningly difficult problem from the point of view that there's so many different kinds of folks using Windows. Like, I think about how different the regular consumer experience is going to be from your typical enterprise, much less, you know, a startup or a highly mobile company. Like, that's a diverse group of folks.
Yeah, it comes down to the infinite regression of whys. You start off with, hey, here's this thing you need. Well, why would you need that? Well, why would you need that? Why would you need that? And eventually you start to come about some truth and you start to validate that truth and say, hey, if we actually did this thing, does that solve your problem? It comes from hearing not just the questions that are being asked or the requests that are being brought in, but trying to understand the underlying context in order to fight for the things that are going to make the biggest difference.
And not to pull up apocryphal stories, that sort of hits me with the whole Henry Ford. If I'd asked a customer what they want, they would have said faster horses, not the automobile. Is that the kind of thing you're getting at? Not that Ford actually ever said that, but it's a great idea.
Yeah, and absolutely. That's sometimes the case. I mean, sometimes the customer has actually understood the problem better than we ever have and is literally just, you know, escorting it across there. You know, in fact, I think a lot of what the challenges that we are trying to break down are just being able to go and hear the requests from the people who actually have this level of insight and bringing that in. I view it, you know, my job as being a human firewall transversal mechanism, right? You know, I just, sometimes we can't get access to information. We're very, very data driven based on the telemetry that's in Windows.
Right.
But the challenge is a lot of people turn off telemetry. And so you are invisible to a lot of the decisions unless, you know, we actually take a human being and walk across and go ask you.
Interesting.
And represent that in and be able to say, hey, here's 100,000 device organization. This number of devices are going to be impacted that might otherwise be invisible. So that, you know, it's not just, hey, turn on telemetry or you are completely ignored. But instead, we can figure out, you know, what's the right way to get your feedback while still being respectful of the needs that you have for security, privacy, and so forth. You know, obviously continuing to evolve telemetry as well to also meet those needs so that we can continue to raise the bar and increase the power of all those conversations.
Okay. Now, and I got to think anybody's turn off telemetry tends to be big org. It's an IT infosec kind of thing that they would shut that stuff off.
Oftentimes it's security, right? And in mm-hmm. some cases, it's sort of understanding the privacy implications behind it. And I think a lot of the work that we've been doing has been, you know, really showing here's exactly what it is.
I've never considered the telemetry you're pulling, having seen the data, to have any privacy implications of any kind, really.
Yeah, and for a lot of people, it doesn't. But, you know, that's is establishing that level of trust. And particularly sure. in today's world where not everyone has the same approach to privacy
right.
as we do. It's obviously super important for us. I can say from the inside, just gaining access to any information that you don't have a specific business need to have access to or that has not been, you know, pretty thoroughly anonymized requires pretty much an act of Congress to make happen.
At least in the United States, anyway.
Indeed.
Has the GDPR impacted telemetry?
It absolutely did in terms of what we had to get configured.
Right.
So, you know, for anyone who has enabled analytics, which, you know, has a telemetry setting dependency, like, you know, you want more information, you turn on more telemetry to get access to that. And what we had to do specific to the right to be forgotten.
Right.
We had to be able to give the end user a way to say, please forget about me and right. have that cascade through. And earlier versions of Windows before GDPR came out and was finalized didn't have the please forget about me button. So we'd said, you know what, everyone, please turn it down to this where there's nothing to be forgotten, right? So get down to the basic level. It will still give you, if you're dependent upon that information, access to some of it. You can turn it up if you want to get deeper and richer information to help you troubleshoot the health of your environment. After you get to 1803, which has that button and gives your users the ability to click it and say, please forget about me.
That's really interesting. And it didn't hit me off the top of my head. It's generally, there's not a lot of person identifiable information inside of telemetry. And correct me if I'm wrong. But yeah, that ability to, even when there is anything identifiable, eliminate this stuff, the right to be forgotten, that's not a small problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, some of the things that, you know, you start thinking about what could be potentially personal are also extremely useful for an organization. So you just got to be mindful about, you know, what is the reason why you need something and what are the local laws for that?
Sure.
And a great example for that would be through a cloud service, what you used to have to set up a whole bunch of infrastructure for, which is for the browser space.
Right.
So we called it IE Site Discovery Toolkit or something like that. It was IE Site Discovery. It was a feature name. And what you can do is say, listen, I'm going to listen in on the sites you go to,
mm-hmm.
and I'm going to give you some key information that can help you to modernize your browser. Do you use ActiveX controls? Do you use a legacy docket mode? So do I need the browser to behave like it's IE5 or 7 or 8 or 9 or 10?
Right.
We can actually gather all of that so that if you're building an enterprise mode site list, you don't have to just find all the sites you know about. You can say, here are all the sites that people are going to. It's super easy to set up a web server. You may discover the stuff that you didn't even know existed.
Absolutely. Happens all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But if, hey, I'm going to this website, that's, you know, potentially something that's personal.
Yeah. No, you're right. It could absolutely be. And they might be as part of a query string. It could be any number of things. That's very subtle that you could run into information issues around that. It's a hard thing to contend with.
Mm-hmm.
So you're the Compat guy. What's changed in terms of that work?
Going way back. I mean, yeah. I think that's how we first met. That was starting in 2006 in Windows Vista is when I started looking after Enterprise App Compat. I know we're getting old, Richard. Well, yeah, I am at least. I'm pretty sure you're ageless.
I don't know about that, but I keep reminding people we've been publishing Run As every Wednesday since April 11th, 2007. And so we went right through the Vista era. Like, that's when we started, really, was that whole time.
Yeah. So one of the big announcements we had in the Compat world, which I think is just a really huge, huge deal, is Desktop App Assure. I assume you heard about that at Ignite?
I did, but let's talk to the listeners about it. What is Desktop App Assure?
Desktop App Assure. So what it is what we came up with, meaning Microsoft, as the way that we can share the risk for the compatibility promise that we're making. So basically, you know, if you are moving to Windows 10 from Windows 7,
I would hope,
or you're moving to a newer build of Windows 10 from an earlier build of Windows 10,
mm-hmm.
right? There's always the potential risk of app compat, right? And yep. We always in the past would say, you know, oh, the risk is low, right? Most everything works. And, you know, the low risk, that turns out to be a somewhat flexible term. I don't know if you recall, we used to say that the compatibility between XP and Vista was very high.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas statistically, the actual number of broken applications going from XP to Vista for the enterprise ended up being around 21% of apps that needed to have some kind of touch to get them working.
You typically, at least UAC-related stuff.
Yes, exactly.
Back in the day, as I recall.
A lot of the changes in default assumptions. Sometimes it was just packaging. Wasn't it? Like I've seen, you know, organizations that had a standard for packaging that would just do a check for version NT.
Right.
Say if it's not equal to 501, then don't run it.
Right. We talked about this app compat where you could actually say, when you go to run this app, let Windows lie to the app.
Yep.
Tell it that this is the version number it wants to see, so that's what you tell it.
Well, we lie by default now. That was starting in 8.1. Yeah, but in the past, we'd always say it was compatibility super high, but then, you know, the burden of proof and the burden of fixing it kind of was left on our customers. And this is something that I was thinking about for a long time, which is how do we share that with you, right? How do we share the risk? So it's not just us making a promise. And if we don't fill it, guess who pays the price?
Sure.
The customer always did in the past, right?
Yep.
You know, you have to pay the price for testing it. You have to pay the price for fixing it, right? So we just make the promise. Obviously, we measure it and, you know, understand that customers will get grumpy with us, you know, if we make them go and fix their things every so often, particularly at the cadence we're going now.
Mm-hmm.
And we sort of look at the problem. We're like, well, you know what? We can't do reliably enough yet is we can't make the testing burden go away.
Right.
Now, statistically, and we were starting to get some statistics. We took a group of customers and we actually gathered a data comprehensively. With that group of customers, we saw less than a 0.3% failure rate. So it's not a lie, right, that we are highly compatible. The challenge we ran into was, even though it's very, very few things that fail, that actually tends to make the remediation problem harder, right? Because back in the UAC days, it's like, yeah, this one feature breaks everything. We can dissect it. We can make tools. We can make automated fixes. We can make manual fixes. And I used to say back in the, you know, Windows 7 transition days coming off of XP, I'd say if you learn 20 shims, you could fix 95% or more of the things you'll ever come across.
Sure.
It's super easy to fix because it's the same thing over and over and over again.
Version numbers, writing in the wrong folders, like those mm-hmm. kinds of things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we've moved from a world where, hey, we're looking for a needle in a needle stack to we're looking for a needle in a haystack.
Right.
Chances are, if you find a compat issue, with all of the energy we're putting into keeping them from happening, it's going to be harder to debug and it's going to be harder to fix. So even though we can't necessarily help you in finding it statistically, because number one, we can't write an automated program to do it. That was actually proven mathematically impossible back in 1936 by Sir Alan Turing. So it can't be done. Like, literally, it is impossible. It's mathematically not feasible for us to do that.
Right.
But you could take some statistical approaches, and of course, we are working on that. But when it comes to, hey, even if we came in and manually do it, I could send a squadron of people into every organization in the world, but they wouldn't know how this stuff is supposed to work. They wouldn't Right. recognize the failures.
Yeah, yeah.
So what we did is we said, all right, so the failures are hard to recognize. We noticed people were over-testing, if you will. They're like, listen, you know, I know not much is going to fail, so I wouldn't test it on my own. But if it does fail, remediation is probably going to be pretty hard. So I better do a little bit more just to make sure that I don't get stuck.
And that's one of those great truths. It's like when you have a real CPAP problem that isn't this window of the easy ones or the known ones, it's a tough one. There's like usually reversion is the only solution.
Exactly. Yeah. Push it back and then go figure it out or contact a developer, figure it out. And right. So what we've done is we've said if anything goes wrong, we've removed all of the friction.
Wow.
Give it to us. We'll fix it for free.
That's a hell of a statement, Chris.
That is exactly the statement, right? We are that serious about it.
Yeah. We're going to do it for you. We're going to solve this for you.
Yeah. And that puts it to me, I'm all about incentives, right? It puts the incentives in the right place.
Sure.
You know, if we put something out and it causes something to break, we have to pay a price for that.
Right. Yeah.
So now our incentive is, hey, don't break it, right? Not only do we not want to break it to avoid irritating our customers, but we also want to make sure that we, you know, we don't have a super expensive service to fix all the stuff that we broke.
Yeah, it costs you money.
Yeah.
No, I think that's pretty powerful. And I need to interrupt you for just a moment, Chris, for this very important message. You've got Windows, Windows 7 and Windows 10. They're domain joined and non-domain joined. They're on-premises and always on the go. And it's your job to make them more secure. But stay calm. That's why you've got Policy Pack. Policy Pack increases your Windows security with your on-premises and roaming PCs. Remove local admin rights, manage all the security settings in your browsers in Java, and tame the Windows 10 start screen and taskbar. Got machines out in the field without the latest group policy settings? Then use Policy Pack Cloud or your own MDM service to deploy real group policy settings to those machines. Only with Policy Pack. Get your free trial today and learn a secret weapon that hundreds of administrators use to manage and secure their Windows 7 and 10 desktops, both on-premises and out in the field. Head over to policypack.com to get started today. Policy Pack, securing your standards. And we're back. It's Richard Campbell here on Run As Radio talking to my friend Chris Jackson about this desktop app Assure. This is kind of a statement of confidence, too, because you guys aren't actually going to break the company on this. Enough stuff works, the chances of an app not working are low enough that you're willing to make that bet.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. In fact, there's a couple of things we've noticed already that I've found very enlightening. Number one, there's a lot of people who are saying we don't have any problems whatsoever. Like we have zero apps that are broken, zero apps that are impacted. But they're calling in anyway to say, I just wanted to be sure you actually exist, because I can't believe you exist, because just knowing someone will have your back is enough to bring people all kinds of newfound confidence.
Yeah,
I mean,
sure.
That is remarkable. And then the sort of the second thing that we've sort of seen as an emerging trend, and I actually blogged about this a few weeks back, which is a lot of people just because they're so used to the volumes of the past. Right? Their last transition most people did, if they're today on Windows 7, was from XP to 7. And they're like, Right. Listen, one in five things I had to do something to. So every time I find an issue, I'm going to immediately punt it and escalate it. And the overwhelming majority of the issues that are coming in are, oh, yeah, you're 17 versions out of date. The new version, the update, it's free. As far as we can tell, it's going to be compatible. Have you tried that? And they're like, oh, I didn't do that homework.
I would also think the biggest whammy going back to the Vista era is a lot of us solved the UAC conflict problems by turning off UAC and making it policy that UAC was off.
Oh, exactly. Well, either that or there's a lot of software that would, you know, sort of be a bridge solution. This is something that was from a security perspective, right? Because I've, in addition to looking after Compat, I've been really, really passionate about security. I'm a cybersecurity enthusiast, if you will.
Right.
And one of the things that I also wanted to make sure that we covered in the desktop App Assure promise was we'll also work with you to retire that technical debt to get to Windows 10 configured using recommended practices.
Right.
So even if your app is broken because of UAC, you can still submit it to us.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll still work with you to get it done. So for folks who either have UAC turned off, there's also a category of customers who bought what I call admin elevation software. So software that will sort of fix the problem, quote unquote, by just giving that app admin rights.
Right.
You know, which is, you know, from a stopgap solution, that's not completely insane.
No, right up until that app gets hacked. And
yeah, it's not perfect. Yeah, because as you point out, is I have gone from a world, you know, because people aren't administrators, programs are administrators. So exactly. I've gone from a world in which all of my programs run as administrator to a world in which a subset of my programs run as administrator. So it's better. Yeah, the challenge is that now instead of all of my apps running as admin, it's only my oldest and worst apps running as admin.
They mean the most hackable ones.
Yeah. So, you know, from a stopgap perspective, from a bridge perspective, that's great. But a lot of people are like, listen, I'm ready to get to the other side of that bridge.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything that can be done with the app to do that? And there are a few examples where we can't, right? And that is the only solution. But for the overwhelming majority, we can, right? And we can suggest here's some alternatives that can help you sort of finish your journey across that bridge, retire that technical debt, a 32 to 64 transition as well. Like yeah. All of those are perfectly okay. It's Windows apps, web apps, also okay, right? So mm-hmm. I want to get this working in IE on Windows 10 the same way it was on Windows 7.
Right.
Even Office, if I'm moving to Office Pro Plus, right? If I'm coming off of Office 2010, also something that we would take a look at. We really are trying to get behind. We want you to succeed in getting to the modern world because we think you're going to really love it there.
And I tend to agree. When it works, it's awesome. It's always the battles. When it doesn't work, but it's good to have you guys on board. In July, we had a Windows update that did a patch to the .NET framework that had impact on a lot of different software. And there's been lots of conjecture and argument around. We did end up doing a whole show just on that whole update process. Was that something that was visible to you and your team?
Yeah, we certainly hear the feedback. And it's something that we're continuing to figure out. How do we get all of the right listening systems in place? But we've kind of, you know, fairly well tuned right now. If you sort of look at the update process as we have it today,
yep.
We actually will start off moving relatively slowly, and we are listening for all of the quietest little ticks in the corner. They're not always that quiet, right? Because people are always sort of looking for what can I make noise about, what's new and interesting.
Sure.
But how do we catch something as early as possible? Obviously, we prefer to move up the stack. We've got a huge insider program. We're continuing to try and figure out ways to make that make sense for enterprise customers, to catch that group of customers, right? Because of differences in the devices they buy, differences in the software they run, they continue to improve the, you know, proactive listening that we have, in addition to the reactive of how do we put things out in such a way that we can continue to manage risk. Because the reality is that there's just no way for us to ever, because we have humans writing software, to ever be completely bug-free. And when you talk about particularly the impact on applications, you know, I've been doing AppCompat now for 12 years.
Right.
And there's just no limits to the ridiculousness of some of the issues that I've seen. It can come down to we have recompiled a binary with a new compiler that managed to improve perf with a new construct that actually reduced one of the threads of execution by a single CPU instruction.
Right.
Just one, right? So three ticks of the processor now gone away. And suddenly I hit a race condition because now that thread finishes first and grabs a lock and I'm in a deadlock.
Yeah.
And that's happened.
No, I remember sticking waits in a stored procedure because when there was a wait there, it didn't deadlock. And when there wasn't a wait there, it did.
Mm-hmm.
Which is sick, but I totally get it. And yeah, you know, you're right. Compatibility can be super subtle. Like these are not easy things and probably not easy to reproduce, you know? Only locks under load at 6 p.m.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So yeah, getting through all of those is very challenging. I wanted to talk a little bit about the Windows Insider program because I hope it's serving you guys well. I love looking at the new versions of Windows, but I don't necessarily test all the software in my organization's on it with the new one. So are there folks out there that are really helping you, making sure running through suites of tests and things with the insider builds and giving you good feedback?
Well, certainly on the consumer side, it's a hugely successful program. You've got millions of people who have signed up for that. I mean, it's a very rich sort of community. In the enterprise space, we're really starting to see a movement that's starting to grow. Because for a long time, the challenge was, how do I keep up at all? Like, I don't need even more regular. I'm still trying to get my arms around and my processes around the cadence that we have today. And so we are starting to see a lot of the customers in organizations that have, you know, now deployed their second, their third, their fourth update to Win 10, getting a process that allows that to make sense.
Right.
And they've figured it out, right? And they know how to do it from both the deployment of the bits perspective. How do I move bits around? How do I manage user downtime so that it's not impacting productivity of my users? And they're starting to get that down. And they're starting to say, hey, listen, for some roles, we want to do this. And I've seen a couple of different approaches. I've seen some orgs that have a lot of internal LOB dev looking at getting into the hands of their devs early. So right. They can see any impact to the applications that they're building relatively early, as well as another org. And you know, the name that they used, I've since sort of glommed onto because I liked it. They call it the Department Technical Coordinator.
Hmm.
And they used a bit of a carrot approach where they said, listen, I would like you to get first exposure to the changes we're planning, not just in Windows, but across the devices. So if I'm, you know, based on SAP, you're going to have the SAP client. If I'm updating Adobe Reader, you're going to get the newest Adobe client for reading PDFs. If I'm doing new hardware, right, when I get the brand new shiny model, you will be the first to get it. So, and a lot of those things are very motivating to people where they want to get the new hardware. They want to try the new software because they like sort of being on that cutting edge. And they sort of distribute that across the organization, and they're starting to put them more into insider builds so they can see it with a bit more frequency because they can, with that subset of users, build pretty sophisticated backup plans, which is, in some cases, multiple different hardware devices. So yep. I can grab a different piece of hardware if that one has a particular issue in one app. VDI, if I can sort of connect in and get an app pushed down to me from the cloud. Then it doesn't have to be perfect. If I run into that, you know, 0.3% chance it happens to hit me, then I have a backup plan to resolve that, in which case I've really managed that risk pretty well with a group of folks who think that that's fun.
Right? Yeah. You do find certain personalities where they really value that and some that don't. I mean, it's really interesting to recognize that diversity
sure.
inside of your organization and then, you know, reward everyone in the process and as well as, you know, overall make systems work even better.
Yeah. Opt-in is really important.
Very powerful.
You hit the nail on the head.
Yeah. It's got to be an opt-in and they got to understand what it's actually about. You know, we talked about, and it's an ongoing subject here on Run As all the time about certainly, for the most part, your users now don't have admin rights. And we've been doing that just enough administration thing pretty heavily around IT. Do you see other admin right issues out there?
We're still trying to get rid of it. I mean, I know it's certainly a movement. A lot of people are thinking about it.
Yeah.
But I still see a lot of organizations that haven't actually executed against that. I mean, it's kind of your on-ramp to the next round of very sophisticated defenses.
Sure.
Because the next big, you know, endpoint configuration that I see that's going to be impactful is application whitelisting.
Right.
You know, getting to a world where I'm not going to run all software just because it's software. Instead, there's going to have to be some kind of vetting process that says whether it's allowed or not. And application whitelisting is a bit of an Achilles heel if the user or the adversary, as the case may be, need only turn off the whitelisting policy
yeah.
in order to run arbitrary bits of software on there. So sort of an on-ramp to that next level, which is now I'm going to use, you know, application control policies in order to, you know, really continue to ratchet down that device in a way that's very appropriate for the device, whether it be the explicit control methodology, which is I'm going to have a list of allowed software,
mm-hmm.
or the approach, and if I don't know if you've come across Aaron Locker at all?
Aaron Locker? Is that a person?
Yeah. It is a person. Yeah, it's a whitelisting approach that actually is derived from the approach that was recommended in a very famous white paper by the NSA, which is basically to whitelist the admin writable areas. So if you're a non-admin, right, anything that you download from the internet isn't going to run because it's not in an admin writable area.
Of course.
Right. And then what has been done recently is Aaron Margosis, who, have you ever had Aaron on your show?
I have had Aaron on specifically talking about app security.
Exactly. We should have him on to talk about Aaron Locker because it's actually a really neat approach. He scripted it and given it away for free. And there's actually an update that just went out this past week. Because in the past, you could write some very simple rules, right? Just put program files in, put Windows in, and you're done. The reality is there's two things that are going to go wrong. Number one, you can change the ACLs in program files to allow someone to write there. And there are a few places in both program files and Windows where standard users can write. And those are therefore not protected.
Right.
Secondarily, there's a few spots that are user writable, a few apps that are going to stop running, such as OneDrive or Microsoft Teams.
Sure.
So you've got to write exclusions for those. And what he's done is written a series of PowerShell scripts that will allow you to build up the default set of rules, to audit and gather the audit information, and build a set of rules that you can use to implement this approach in the real world, a very pragmatic way to go about putting defenses in. But the key starting point is you got to be a standard user to get started.
That, which is awesome, right? That's definitely falling to the pit of success. You have to have this, you know, now you have an incentive to make that work. I'm wondering if we don't start getting into this whole container model and sort of desktop virtualization as just part of the next stage of this kind of security where we can granularize privileges even in more detail.
Yeah, and containerization, I mean, certainly you see it already in what we're doing in both MSIX, which we talked about at Build,
yep,
and what we talk about in Defender Application Guard. So mm-hmm. Application Guard is already live and fully usable today in Microsoft Edge. So you're actually running it in a separate Hyper-V container. MSIX is going to allow you to have various degrees of containers. So we have, you know, anything from a Helium container, which is, you know, isolating file system registry, to an app container, which is actually changing the security construct of the process token. And even, you know, at some future days, we continue to evolve AppGuard to put things into a Hyper-V container supported through MSIX and giving that ability to target things. And then what you just need to understand, and a lot of people discovered some of this, is if you isolate everything from each other, for security, it's fantastic.
Right.
For compatibility, it can have some impacts because when it expects to find the other piece of software, now it's in a container, now it can't.
Yeah, yeah. No, but it also means sort of explicitly giving permissions mm-hmm. to allow those different pieces of software to speak to each other. We're going to have to build up a manifest of that.
Yeah, pinpoint holes and figuring out how do you have a broker and how do you defend that broker. I mean, we had to solve a lot of that for having Edge in AppGuard because a really key scenario, if I'm just navigating the big bad web, I find a picture and I'm like, oh, I'd like to use that picture in some document.
Right.
Right click, save as, if I'm in a container, doesn't get where I think it's going to go unless I have a broker process that can escrow it across into the trusted environment for me.
Hey, wait, you guys solved this with Windows when we were saving stuff in the wrong locations. You kind of already know all about that.
Yeah, we do. They do it for app containers, have to do it as well. I mean,
sure.
There's been broker processes in IE since, you know, we first introduced protected mode way back in the day.
Yeah, it's really interesting to think of all those pieces coming together. So this sounds like we're still on a path here, right? There's still a lot to do to make this better.
Yeah, you've got to deal with the world as it exists today. And that's
right.
A really important part of, you know, what Microsoft is always trying to do is what we don't want to do is say, you can get to this nirvana. All you have to do is rewrite everything you've ever built.
Yeah, I remember that nirvana. Challenging to get to.
Exactly. Right? How do we continue to deliver incremental value? That's a really core value of what we continue to try and build. So we want to shake things up. We want to challenge even our former selves, right? We did this for this reason. Does that reason still make sense? It's about smartly challenging your previous self while being mindful of people have invested a huge amount into their Win32 estates, and it really makes a big difference to them. It's driving their businesses in countless ways. we don't want to underplay the importance of that investment.
Absolutely.
But we also want to help them achieve that, not just some diluted version of that, but to really challenge ourselves to think about how can we actually get you to this endpoint without disruption. And we know that, you know, some of them have, you know, the UAC and the transition to standard user. Well, let's face it, it was disruptive. Right? That was our best attempt at making it as non-disruptive as possible. And we, you know, the longer we waited, the harder it was going to be, the bigger the problem would be. The tech could have been better to make it easier, but the problem then would have been bigger. And it's a matter of timing to figure out how do we do that. Same with whitelisting, same with containers, is continuing to figure out what's the right time to strike, what's the right level of maturity for the platform, the tooling, the processes, so that we can actually get you across with, you know, maybe a skinned knee here or there, but we don't want to have you have a broken bone and go, wow, that was terrible. I'm never doing that again.
Yeah, you definitely want to do better than that. Chris, always fun to talk to you. I know there's still some challenges out there, but it does seem like you guys are moving in the right direction.
Right, we're certainly trying. I mean, what I will say, you know, from my perspective is I'm just trying to hear what everyone has to say. So, you know, sure. I'm trying to stay as engaged as possible through the socials, through all that, as well as, you know, direct conversations. And, you know, anyone can feel free to reach out to me anytime, because my role is really to be your advocate in figuring out how do we really build the next generation enterprise experience without saying throw away all your old stuff.
Start over. Yeah. And what's the best way to reach you these days?
At AppCompatGuy on Twitter, which is pretty quick and painless way to do that. My blog at AppCompatGuy.com, which kind of redirects to my corner of the IT pro world. And, you know, also I'm AppCompatGuy at Microsoft.com.
There's a theme here.
You noticed that, huh?
I picked it up. Chris Jankson, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Great. Thanks, Richard.
And we'll talk to you next time on Run As Radio.